Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to another Rahalastra Book Club. I am delighted to be joined by Matt Baker, who is talking about a fantastic book called Normal Schmormal, My Occasionally Helpful Guide to Parenting Kids with Special Needs. Hello, Ashley.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, although I will warn you, I had a COVID booster yesterday and I have a sore arm. Shouldn't hurt, shouldn't really affect a podcast, a sore left arm.
But I hope not. I won't punch you in the arm. No. It's like the BCG of old. Mind my BCG. It's the new 21st century BCG. Lovely to see you, Ashley. I obviously know you and we've worked together in the past. But for people who are unaware of who you might be, could you give us a little rundown of who you are and what you've done before this book?
I've had several phases of my life that I've been through. So I've started in a comedy sense. I was a producer for many years at the BBC in radio and comedy, and started making Little Britain in January 2000, and made many panel shows, some of which we've worked on together, had you on as a guest, what have you. And then somehow, weirdly, I moved into performing at some point about 6-7 years ago, and now I've written my first book as well. So which is based actually on a Radio 4 series that of my own called Ashley Baker 6.5 Children. And the book is it kind of spins off of that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting decision to go. I mean, a few producers have then gone to comedy, or a few comedians have been produced. Like Armando Iannucci is a good example. He was a performer, a big producer, who then performed and now directs and produces. So, you know, it's not that these jobs are unconnected. But you were a producer for a long time before. And I know you tried out stand-up when you were a teenager, right?
I did. That's right. I did. I did stand-up when I was, like, 16.
Right.
I would say I was quite good. I will say I was good for a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
But shit by any general standard, I think. I mean, they would either go, and they would sometimes, the audiences would either love it, or they would just decide there is no way we're going to laugh at a spotty teenager, and would just heckle me off. And there was no way, I didn't have any of the skills to ever turn it around. So if the audience decided they didn't like me, that was it. I really should have got off in the first minute. There's no point in carrying on.
I think it's very hard because, you know, obviously most comedy gigs are at least, you know, people in their 20s. I'll call them adults. I remember the same when kids and teenagers did stand up. As a stand up, you're always a bit skeptical and a bit like, oh, and it could go one of either ways. Jack Carroll was an example of someone who did very well with it. But mainly,
some of them went really well.
Yeah.
Some of them went really well. But I guess you just don't have at that age, you just don't have. Well, certainly I didn't have any of the skills to turn around if it wasn't going well.
No, exactly. And it was, you know, I think you're on a hiding to nothing, really. But yeah, I mean, it's a very brave thing to attempt. So what was it? I'm just kind of interested in what kind of swung you back that way. Was it, you're a very successful producer and, as you say, worked on Little Britain and Rock Profiles, which was one of my absolute favourite shows of all time.
Oh, thank you, yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, I'll tell you exactly what happened. And it was real serendipity. What happened was, so... Again, talking about different phases of my life, I have had a series of what I can only call hyperfixations. And I should say, I've written this book. It's called Normal Schmormal, My Occasionally Helpful Guide to Parents of Kids with Special Needs. And it's about my children and their special needs. I have an adopted daughter with Down syndrome, two sons with autism and ADHD. But having written the book, I actually realized, you know what? I could have been writing about myself. And I decided after writing it to get myself assessed. And I will be writing an extra chapter about this in the paperback. I've actually written it in the paperback edition. So I was recently diagnosed myself with autism and ADHD.
Yes.
That's the face of a man thinking, well, I could have told you that.
Well, also, you're a comedian. You know, you're a comedian probably means that you've got an 8 in 10 chance. But yeah, you know, yeah.
Exactly. So I have had a huge number of incredible hyperfixations in my life, one of which, bizarrely, was a kind of 10-year adherence to, I mean, I am Jewish. I mean, I was born Jewish, will die Jewish. But a 10-year adherence to very strict Orthodox Judaism. And during that period, I once got an email from a rabbi who said, someone was telling me about you, and apparently you very religious Jew and very observant, but you work with all these famous people, and you've written Graham Norton, you work with Lucas and Williams, and et cetera, et cetera. And that sounds quite interesting. I'm sure I'd love you to come and talk to us about it. I didn't even think to even ask for any money. I think that you might have given me a bottle of whiskey. And I went and spoke to this community about my life. And you know, because obviously I'd been a comedian, but certainly I'd been a writer and producer and what have you, I could make it funny, and I liked hearing laughs. You know what it's like when it's a bit like being a smoker, and you know, you take your first drag of a cigarette for the first time in years. I love this. The audience are laughing. This is great. And so he must have told other people, because suddenly I kept getting more requests, right? And every time I did it, I made it a bit funnier, and I put in a few more jokes. And at one point, I just thought, you know what? I'd like to just turn this into a bit of stand up. And try and I didn't. Suddenly, it's like I've got a show on Radio 4, and I'm doing two off Broadway shows, and it just took off, and I'm touring around the world. It was it's the strangest, real, just serendipity is the only word for it, really. Yeah.
Are you still? Have you now relaxed? I thought you were going to say the rabbi called me and said, "Dial it down a bit, mate. You're being a bit too."
No, exactly. Well, you know what the weird thing is that I became very religious, there's another book to be written here about how I ended up in effectively what's a cult and then ended up leaving it. But what I will say is that becoming very religious led to me touring as a stand-up around the world, which led to me not being doing it anymore, because it's one of those things that you have to kind of just do by rote every day, going and doing the same things. And suddenly I was off doing other stuff. It's been an odd life.
It's really interesting, actually. It's a great story. Yeah, as you say, I'm sure there's another book in there. Obviously, your Jewishness is a part of this book. But this book, as you've said, is really about being a parent of kids with special education needs and without as well. So, I mean, you've got six kids, which would be enough for me. I've got two kids who, as far as I know, don't have any special education needs, but they are both the children of two comedians. So there's every chance something's going to appear. So far, neither of us have been diagnosed with anything, but that's only because we haven't tried. So two kids is hard. I've got a friend who's a comedian with five kids, and I've been round to his house, and it was absolute fucking bedlam, and he seemed unable to cope with it. So just having six kids is incredible, but, you know, an incredible thing to have to navigate and get through. But obviously this, you have extra challenges on top of that. So do you want to, I want to do my bit from Encanto. I love Encanto. So many kids in your house, so let's turn the sound up. You know why? I think it's time for a Blake a Kid Roundup. That's from Encanto. But there's a lot of kids in your house. Do you want to take us through who everyone is?
So, well, the great thing is that people always will always say to me, God, must be mental in your house and what have you. And it certainly was. This book is written on 19 years of lived experience. Yeah. My eldest son is now 19. He works he has autism and ADHD. He was, to put it mildly, a handful as a child. An absolute wild force of nature. He was diagnosed with autism and ADHD when he was three. But his story alone is quite remarkable. He now works at Terminal 3 at Heathrow in security. He's one of those people who's telling you to get your laptop out your bag. He was telling me recently that whenever they see a dildo on the screen, they always stop the person just to embarrass them. And so whatever you do, pack it, put your dildos in a checked luggage. Don't put it in the carry-on.
I mean, that was good advice. Unless it's a very long flight, you know, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, because him and his friends will be stopping you just to embarrass you. So, yeah, so, you know, he's out and he works he loves work and he works often 6 days a week. So he's not in the house. My next son is 18 and he's in year 13, final year of school. The old upper six in old money. And then the next son is nearly 16. So they're teenagers. But and obviously, you know, the challenge has changed. Suddenly it's most of my time is, can you drive me here? Can you drive me there? Can you pick me up? Et cetera. But it certainly was absolute chaos. But the idea was, this book was, to be honest, I just wanted to write the book that I wish I'd read myself 16 years ago. Because when my eldest son was diagnosed, I read loads of books and around the subject, and they were so bloody depressing. Oh, my God. I mean, it just really miserable outlook. I just thought, at least I just wanted to not shy away from the challenges, because there are many, many challenges, and certainly don't shy away from them, but wanted to write something that at least is positive and hopeful and hopefully funny as well.
Yeah, so, you know, and it definitely is that. I mean, I think it is a book that everyone can read. I think it is definitely probably more, you know, more focused on parents with special educational needs. But, you know, I think, you know, with any book, I think, you know, you want to get a glimpse into a life that isn't your own as well. So although you give advice and, you know, most of which is, you know, you have to work it out for yourself, but it's still very helpful, because obviously every situation is different. I think it's, you know, it's very helpful as a parent just to see someone else admitting to struggling with screens, screen time, and, you know, kids fighting and kids disagreeing. So, you know, I think everyone will get something out of this. And as you say, it is funny as well as being traumatic at times and worrying at times. And, you know, you're a very obstinate person yourself. Which, you know, I think the chapter about you trying to get one of your kids into school you wanted to get into.
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't like to have dealt with you, even though I think you were clearly in the right and, you know, legally in the right. That school, you know, must have thinking, oh, this guy will, This guy's going to give up in a second.
No, well, this is what I think a lot of schools, so a lot of parents of kids with special needs go through this kind of thing, either in terms of they don't want the kids or they don't want to provide the help that's necessary, whatever. And it is a bit of a battle. And parents have got the weight of the law usually on their side. But I think they do rely on basically being such assholes. They will go away. And that's exactly what we had. So, so that's in the chapter. So I say, the book is, as you know, is a A to Z, but appropriately for about kids who might find learning difficult, it's all in the wrong order. It's all jumbled up. The first chapter is M is for meetings, meetings, meetings. And the chapter you're talking about is called N is for no room at the inn. And we did have an absolute nightmare with our eldest son, as the school we wanted him to go to just wouldn't play ball at all. And even when the local council said, you've got to take him, they took it to Ed Balls himself, the now star of Good Morning Britain, is it? Yeah,
thank you.
But at the time was Secretary of State for Education, what have you. They even then wanted to take it to the House of Lords. Actually, that chapter, bizarrely, if you think, oh, you might be making some of this up, I've toned that down because it was it's just too unbelievable. They do rely on, and I should say as well, a lot of people at the time, and I do say this in the book, said, well, hang on, they didn't want you. It just seems strange why you would have fought such a battle. Yeah. But the truth is, we really did believe it was a very good school, and which is why when he did eventually get in, our relationship with them, we did repair the relationship quite a lot, and we trusted them. There was no point in fighting and then just trying to micromanage. That would have been nonsensical. So we did leave him to go on with it. And he left, secondary school, that's my eldest, Adam. He went to more schools than an Ofsted inspector. But in primary school, he did go all the way through to the end of year six and enjoyed it, made friends. And it was actually a pretty much a positive experience.
Yeah, well, I think it shows the importance of digging your heels in if you're right. And like you say, I think a lot of people would go, I don't want to go to this school, they seem like dicks. But you obviously did the right thing. So it's a testament to you, written by yourself, admittedly, but but it's still great.
Yeah, yes, you've only heard my side of the story.
but I do.
You know what? It was so writing this book was quite traumatic at times because there were some things that were very recent. I can remember, anecdotes that are just very fresh in the mind, and some things that I either were a long time ago or that I purposely buried, and I had to dig through a lot of emails. I kept all the emails. I kept all the paperwork. So for that chapter, I only hear my side of the story, but it's really based not just on memory, on proper sources. I read history, so I was doing a history PhD, so I prided myself on my sources, there was no 17th century manuscript, frankly, in this one.
But, equally, as a reader, you think, Christ, this family are going through this with one of their children, but they have, well, maybe didn't have five others at that exact time, but, you have several other kids, each with their own individual needs as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, this is the thing that any parents of children, certainly neurodivergent children, would know. A child isn't born and the midwife looks at a baby and goes, oh, your child is autistic. These are things that will get assessed and, a snail's pace. These things can take forever. As I say, my eldest son was diagnosed at 3. Our third son was diagnosed at 6. I was diagnosed at 48. So who knows, when these things are going to kind of become uncovered. And so had we known, had our eldest son been born and you were told immediately, look, just so you know, your son has got autism, ADHD. He's not going to talk till he's like 7 or 8. He's going to be an absolute handful. We might have thought twice about having more children, but we didn't know. And that's the thing. You just carry on blindly going, yes, go on. This seems like a good idea. We can handle another one. And then, as I say, we had, there's a chapter about our two chapters actually about our adoption.
Yeah.
Of we had four sons. And then we just saw this very strange advert. I've never, literally never seen anything like it since. It's not like I've, you know, you look through a local newspaper and, oh, we saw one of those adverts about adopting a child. Weirdly, it's the only time I've ever seen anything like it. There was an advert from the London Borough of Hackney about a child. It had a photo of this child. In the advert, she was called Deborah, not her real name. That was the pseudonym they used. And it said, Deborah is 1 year old. She's got Down syndrome. She's a gorgeous child. Whatever. And for some reason, I saw this. My wife saw it. And we just thought, you know what? We could do this. And ended up, it was a long old process, but ended up adopting her. So, yeah we were just taking on, just obviously thought our life wasn't hard enough.
Definitely an extraordinary family. And most people, even without kids, might think twice about adopting a kid with Down syndrome. So it's sort of a slightly almost baffling, but then actually, of course, admirable. And you do, you know, you go through your thought process and it does make sense. And it's been, as well as a difficult experience, a very rewarding experience.
It's a very rewarding experience. I mean, I will be totally honest. If I'd, you know, I don't say this lightly at all, had I known quite how challenging it would be even now, she's just turned 15. Right. She came to live with us when she was two. I think we might have thought twice. I absolutely love her. I'm not suggesting we give her back, as it were. But, and she is part of what makes our family what it is. But, oh my God, she is challenging. she's kind of plateaued. She's 15. She's going through teenage hormones, etc. But she's also she's not like toilet trained. She wears nappies. She's, you know, she requires a lot of personal care. And she needs to be watched the whole time. Recently, we had no hot water in the house. And I called, and I called the plumber. He's hunting around. He just can't work out the problem. And realized that there's just a switch in the utility room. She's just turned off. Very kind man. He didn't charge us, but that you can't watch her because you can't take your eyes off her, because she will take scissors and cut her hair. She'll draw on the walls. She'll draw on her face. She looks like a kind of Down syndrome post Malone with all scribbles all over her face. She turns off the heater. You know, she just needs to be watched the whole time. Yeah. And yes, so had I known that, but there you go. These are the things you. It seemed a good idea at the time, and we do love her very much.
Of course. So, but, you know, you're a very impressive family, and it's very, it's a very humane and wonderful thing to do. Even if you had your own kids, and there was several, I guess most people who adopt, maybe I'm wrong about this, but most people who adopt don't have kids, I would have thought.
I think that's a lot of the case. No, it's a very unusual, case all round. So normally what happens is you will be a set. So let's say someone decides they want to adopt, maybe they don't have children, as you say, often the case. And then that will take like best part of a year to be assessed. And it's a very grueling process. I go into it a little bit in the book. Some of the odd questions they ask you about your child. They ask questions like, did you go to many birthday parties when you were in primary school? Why are you asking this? I don't understand the relevance. They're trying to kind of get this big picture of you of what you're like. But then having approved you, let's say you go for a year, they go to this panel, this adoption panel, they approve you. Then you might wait years to be matched to a child, someone who they say child X can be matched with family Y. Ours was a very unusual case because it was we had no desire to adopt per se. It was purely this child who we had seen advertised, so it was purely for her. It's very hard. I do talk about the thought process, but I still can't really explain it beyond a kind of moment of madness or divine inspiration. I just don't know. Something came over us. We thought we could do that. I was tempted to call Hackney and say, would you take a part exchange for Adam? They wouldn't hear of it. So it was either her or couldn't get rid of any other kids. That was it. And we ended up doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you're making, as a parent, you're tired. You make impetuous decisions. This is in no way similar to your case, but we moved house, had a child, and decided to get a puppy at the same time. And that was that was the craziest. It was all spaced out in our minds, but then it all happened at exactly the same time, and the house wasn't ready. And we had the worst fucking 6 months of our lives as a result of that. So, you know, we look back and go, why did we take a dog at the same time as doing all those other things? I think sometimes you don't think as a parent, and sometimes you just make a decision. But, you know, again, maybe you're like me. I think I like to put myself in challenging positions to see if I can, and that's a, see if you can get out. And that's a sort of stand up thing, isn't it? I often in a stand up gig will almost try and throw it to see if I can win it back again. You know, so there's a sort of weird, like, let's make this a bit more, let's make this very difficult thing a bit more difficult.
That was me at 16, I suppose. I wasn't attempting, I wasn't throwing it. That was every gig. I was just seeing if I could win it back. But I think that we are 100% both people, even notwithstanding what I was talking about, my own diagnosis, I think we are people who don't like standing still. There are some people who, I know, like, I have one brother, he's very, you know, he's kind of been the same, as like, he's had the same haircut even since, I can remember, since he was 18 or whatever. Some people stay the same. My parents are very much like that. They had the same friends since I can remember. They go on holiday to the same places, eat in the same restaurants, do the same things. And some people love that. We've just not like that. We are always going, we're settled, so let's completely throw it all by moving or adopting a little girl with Down syndrome, or, you know, so I think that's something you share. It's that thing of just going, yeah, go on then, let's just, we're settled, let's not rest on our laurels, let's do something mental now.
And all this time, and I think neither of you are working, you're both working, you're doing this very high powered job, you're doing a job that occasionally takes you away from home for weeks on end, or, you know, and having to parent via Zoom.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I mean, you know, it's an incredible thing, but it shows that it's possible to get through it. I think anyone would read this. I can't imagine many people are in the position you're in, where they've got so many kids. So most people are going to read this and go, okay, well, if those guys can manage this, then I've got a chance of managing it too, which I think is one of the most sort of instructive things about it. Because as I say, I don't think your advice is very good, I think, but it's also, it is very much like, you know, embrace and accept your situation. Well, you know, it's not saying you have to do this in this situation. It's about knowing what your own particular case is.
Yeah, I think, look, I think there's a real need for, I suppose if there's any one central message as well, it's about embracing diversity, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because I think we, you know, we're very good at embracing diversity in many aspects of life. You know, we're used to seeing very different kinds of people on TV or hearing them on radio or what have you. But we're, most people like to hang out with and surround themselves with people who are identical to themselves. Also, we're quite good at accepting neurodiversity in adults. And you know, we, I think I mentioned this in the book, that like how many comedians, I mean, as you said earlier, like half the comedy circuit has been diagnosed with some degree of neurodiversity in the last few years. And you know, and it makes you think, God, wow, if Sue Perkins or Johnny Vegas or Fern Brady, look, think how brilliant all these comedians are. And so we should be great. We should be grateful to all our neurodiverse people for the wonderful comedy they've given us and art and all the rest of it. But yet we're not very good at accepting it from kids.
No, it's true.
And you know, when there's a kid on the tube or in the supermarket having a bit of a meltdown, we're not very good at accepting that. People still kind of tut or look and it's still very uncomfortable. And it'd be great if we could extend the same acceptance that we do to all of the aforementioned people that we do to children. That would be a wonderful thing. So I think if there is one kind of big message, that's it.
And I think that's also true for all kids, right? That we're trying, you know, you've got to mould them a little bit and try and make them into well-formed human beings and adults. But, you know, it's very tempting. My son is a very rambunctious, you know, like most five-year-olds, like many five-year-old boys, you know, running around, not doing what he's told, you know, loves to laugh, loves to try and make jokes, and some of them are funny and some of them aren't. And, you know, it's very difficult to go, hey, you want to be. But I think whilst you can't do it all the time, you have to kind of let them be themselves, you know. I think, you know, so it is, well, yeah, it's interesting for everyone is what I'm saying. You know? I think it's an interesting.
No, there's a tempting thing with parenting, I think, that you see people often judge their success by wanting to turn their children into kind of little mini-me's, clones of themselves and what have you. And I've seen it in my own life. I mean, my parents, bless them, I don't want to knock them too much by any means. Think about like my religious journey, there was a period when they thought I was too religious. They just couldn't understand it. They just thought I was insane. And then I've kind of gone the other way, and my recent hyperfixation is tattoos.
I noticed that in one of your interviews. Yeah, you've got a lot of tattoos.
And now they kind of furious about that, and I've gone too far the other way. And you know, you're kind of like, you're never going to be, basically, really, you'd only be happy if I was exactly the same as you. You have set the gold standard. Now that's in one very specific thing, but I do think that is. I see that with parents all the time. And I think it's really hard. It's really hard to kind of be accepting enough just to say, look, you do you and we will support you and try and give you advice when asked and what have you, but let you make your own mistakes. And I think that's, it's about practicing accepting your own reality of what your family looks like and what your children are like, and then accepting them as they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's good.
It's much harder than it sounds.
It is very hard. It's very hard. But, you know, absolutely, you're entirely right. Now, I listened to the audio book, which is a lot of fun. What I like as well, I mean, I think it's great, always great to have a comedian read their own book. So that, I mean, it really helps with you understanding where the jokes are, I think, and the delivery, because sometimes people won't, you know, deliver it in the right way. But there's a nice chapter which is written by your kids, but also in the audiobook read, or at least, I don't know if it's improvised for the audiobook or if it's written in the book, because I listen to the audiobook.
Yes. Oh, you listen to the audiobook. Yes, yeah. So one of the chapters is called K is for Kids, Kids Have Their Say. And then so we record. It's very short. It's mostly my kids kind of swearing. And so, yes, they actually recorded it. They came to the studio and recorded it. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. I will say that was one of the things. I'm a nightmare to work with because I always think I can do it better. I always think that, and particularly because I've been a producer, I always just think, I want to produce this myself. And I that chapter, I actually was saying, I was like over the engineer's shoulder going, well, can't it be, can we not have like Atmos and a bit, they need to be talking over each other. There's a scene, they're kind of just all chatting. And he went, oh no, this isn't, you know, this is an audio book. It's not a radio play. You go, yeah, I know, but it just sounds, what it ends up sounding like to me, I'm just a bit of a self-critic, to me it ends up sounding like they're reading a book. Which is exactly what they are doing. That is the point of an audiobook. But to me, I want it to sound more like the Radio 4 show, that they're chatting and yeah. There you go. But that's only, it's about.
I think it's pretty good. I think it does sound pretty, you know, given the strictness of it. I think it does, you know, but I love the idea of you sacking that's your good. Own children for not performing well enough. So well done.
That's no, they're it wasn't their performance. It was the audio, it was HarperCollins audio team. My children, I thought, were pretty good. They'll sit and swear quite happily.
Yeah, there's also a chapter written by your wife that she doesn't read out, and it's suspiciously nice about you. And I wondered whether she actually wrote it, whether you are even married is my big
no. Question. That is no. So there is a chapter that is just S is for spouse, which is again it's quite a short chapter. It's about clearly written. The joke is written by me, and in fact, my editor said to me. Is Gemma going to read that chapter? And that would ruin the joke. That's not going to work. The whole point is that it's just praising me. But no, the kids are very. It is an important point that people have said to me. You know, how do your kids feel? You've written about them. You've written some quite revealing things. There's some potentially embarrassing anecdotes and what have you. How do they feel about that? And to say they've read it or they've involved with it and they've say there was I've done two series of the show on Radio 4 called 6.5 Children, which they perform as themselves in it. So they're very kind of invested. And I think that's really important to me. I wouldn't have wanted to do this if they weren't kind of fully on board. I think that was really important.
Yeah, it's always difficult. I mean, comedians have to deal with this all the time, right? The people you're writing about, you know, that you do routines about are real people often, if the stories are real. And you do have to think about that. And obviously, when it's your own kids, even if they're happy or they don't know, you know, my kids don't know about this stuff I'm doing about them largely, but there might come a point where they go, I don't like that. I think John Ronson went through that anyway. He'd write about his son in a very entertaining Guardian column, and eventually his son went, I don't really like this anymore. And so he had to, you know, he did the right thing and he stopped doing it. So, I mean, that's all you can really do, I think, is based on whatever they're telling you at the time.
Yeah, no, but so I've read quite a few books of, not just comedians, but, you know, parenting memoirs about being a parent, a mother, a father, what have you. There's quite a few out there. What I will say about them, and I personally find it a little bit frustrating sometimes, is that for obvious reasons, the children will be very anonymous. You often won't even get their names. Yeah. You certainly won't see photos and what have you. What I will say about my book, one of the things that I like about it the most is the children are the stars. It's not about me. It's about them. They are the stars of it. People who've read it have said to me, oh, my favorite is this one. My favorite is that one. They're the stars. It's not about me. And I think I really like that aspect of it. I wanted readers to get to know my kids. I think they are very funny, entertaining, interesting characters. And I think that's something that I hope comes across. You really get to know them. Who's your favourite? Did you have a favourite?
I do like, now I'm going to get the names wrong, Zoe. Is that right?
Yes, yes,
and, yes. And, yes. The Bailey is obviously a legend. You get to know them.
That's the thing. That's it. Exactly. You get to know them.
It's not fair to make me choose my favourite child of yours. Actually.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Exactly. Exactly. I wouldn't. Exactly. That's fair enough.
No, Zoe's clearly your favourite. So, you know.
So Zoe's the one we adopted. Yes. Yeah, so yeah. Well, she is, because she's the only. She is the. I would say she's the absolute kind of jewel in the crown, because she's the only one who shares none of my genes. So she doesn't talk shit all day. She doesn't, she's never manipulative. She's never hurled an Argos catalogue at my head while shouting, you know, I like football, where my goalposts. She's an unfussy eater. She's not, that's the thing. She doesn't have any of my, suspect genes. So, you know, she's that's why.
That's fair enough. And we haven't talked about the fact that you have a good way of delineating. And it's always very hard, I think, to... I've talked about this through my work with Scope and stuff, that it's very difficult to use the correct words for everything, especially when you're talking about people who aren't disabled. I had a discussion with someone at a Scope event. I said, well, you know, we can't say not disabled. Abled seems wrong. And she said, right, we call you the not yet disabled, which I think is a fantastic... a fantastic way of describing whatever you're going to call it, and they're not yet disabled. You've got quite a pretty good way of describing, you know,
Yes. So I didn't want to reuse these terms again and again, but with, you know, neurotypical, neurodivergent, disabled, not disabled, yeah. So throughout the book, they are called Zappers and Coldplay. So mainstream children are like Coldplay. Perfectly good, but rather boring. Like Keir Starmer, you know, they're like the missionary position, basically. That's what they're referred to throughout as Coldplay. And then special needs children are more like avant-garde, in comparison, they're like avant-garde musicians, like a Captain Beefheart or a Patti Smith or a Frank Zappa. So I refer to them throughout as Zappers, because they're like Frank Zappa. They don't, you know, they're rebellious, alternative, sometimes unspeakably shit, but they don't care. They don't like Frank Zappa. They don't give a fuck. And that is why I love them. They just don't care. So just as a Frank Zappa doesn't care whether he's selling enough records or whether, your CDs are going to sell in Sainsbury's, that's kids with special needs. And I really, that again actually seems to be something that people have really kind of latched onto. When I look at reviews on Amazon and what have you, it always seems to be, as a parent of two Zappers, or as a parent of, it's something that language, because I think it's really the kind of really positive thing, that it's not something that's to be, you know, sad about or embarrassed of or what have you. And just in the same way that I was always one of those annoying muso types who I specifically want to listen to the music no one else listens to, because, it's too challenging for you who would listen to mainstream music. I'm also parenting the children, who would be too challenging for most. But that's the thing. This is the kind of the avant-garde children.
Yeah. Coldplay's a bit cruel on the other way, but I think maybe I kind of wonder, you know, like the problem with kids is they'll turn anything into an insult. So every time you try and make something more palatable, kids will manage to find a way. But I think Zappa is quite hard to, also they won't really know what it means, but it sort of just sounds like Zappa. It sounds like a kind of cool thing. I don't think it can be used in a pejorative way, but you know, kids of the world prove me wrong.
I know it's always amazing what, you know, I was telling my kids about, you know, Joey Deacon and how well intentioned Blue Peter was in having Joey Deacon on TV, and how that became the biggest playground insult. But I was on, what show was it? I think Morning Live on BBC One. And I mentioned this, and a woman emailed me and said that her son was now calling himself Zach the Zapper.
Oh, great.
And I loved that. I absolutely loved that. I thought it was so wonderful. Yeah. And I like Coldplay. Don't get me wrong. I do actually like Coldplay. So I think the analogy still works, because I do like Coldplay. But there's something about, yes, it's just a bit, it's just, yeah, more out there, more challenging.
Yeah. And there's tons, I should really say as well with this book, you know, as it takes the subject seriously. I think comedy is a great way to deal with serious subjects, as most comedians understand. And I think you're absolutely right. I think a dry book about my struggles would not be as interesting and would not be as engaging. And there's lots and lots of funny things. I think my favourite thing is Johnny Vine. I don't know if that's his real name or if you've changed his name. You've blurred him out in the photo.
I did change his name. And I emailed him. I tracked him down. He was a man from LA. So it's really weird, actually. So basically, do you want to tell me why you?
It's a really funny story. Okay. So it's the kids, because there's so many of you, you can't all sit on the same row in the aircraft, and you need to be an adult on every row. So someone has to reluctantly volunteer on the plane.
Somebody reluctantly, this man. So basically, we were flying to Greece. They said, look, the plane can't take off unless somebody moves and sits with my three other kids. So this man from LA, his real name, well, it doesn't matter his real name. Yeah, I just made it slightly less Jewish, to be honest. But his name was Yoni Weinstein. Anyway, the funny thing was, he went and sat next to Dylan, my third son. And he basically, and it was very kind of him, he was from LA. They'd been flying to London. He was really tired. He wanted to sleep and what have you. They were now flying on to Greece, him and his family. And he sits down next to my son, and my son says to him, like, where are you from? He says, oh, LA. And suddenly he just is like, do you live near the studio? Do you know Adam West? My son is obsessed with Batman. Do you like The Simpsons? He says, do you like The Simpsons? This poor man stupidly went, yes. And suddenly he's like launched into favorite episode, least favorite episode, best cameo. He's like performing entire episodes. He's singing the Stonecutter song. Every time I kind of go back, he's just, look, this poor man is having to listen for 4 hours. My son just witter on for 4 hours. And then the funny thing was, we do have a photo of him in the book. I need to get in touch with him to clear it. I spent ages, people I knew in LA saying, do you know this person? Do you know this family? And after months of tracking him down, I got his email address and then realized at that point that I already had his email address in my phone anyway. So he'd given me his email address at that time. So I'd wasted months of trying to track down a man whose number was in my phone. I hadn't thought to look. And then he said he really liked it. But fair enough. I don't know if I'd want my photo in of someone else's book. But there you go. So
when he comes, you know, he should have his phone because he comes across very well from me. It's just
incredibly kind man.
It's a lovely. So I just like the, you know, being called by his full name all the time as well. I know you've done this as a Radio 4 show, so it's already started as a comedy show, but it does feel like ripe for being a TV sitcom.
There's one chapter, I think it's probably my favourite chapter in the book, actually, even though it's not, lots of advice, a chapter about meetings with schools, a chapter about hospital appointments, a chapter about dietary issues, what have you. There's one chapter just called V is for Various Times My Children Have Humiliated Me, which is just 5 anecdotes, and there's no kind of even attempt at trying to garner any advice from it beyond here are just 5 funny anecdotes. And I think they're kind of 5 sitcom scripts, really. Yeah. And I won't spoil it, but there's a story that involves my children. Well, the use of not using the N word, but misunderstanding what the N word is short for, and embarrassing themselves and us. And I mean, yes, it kind of feels like it could be a
Definitely, because the actual word is so unlikely that it just sounds like you're lying anyway. So it's an absolutely perfect bit of comedy.
It sounds completely made up and isn't at all. It has a story of this very odd story about my third son, my fourth son, who was caught in, again, this is totally true, he was caught in the computer room at school. And got banned and searching for things online that he shouldn't have been. And we assumed, well, he's like, he was 12 at the time. Maybe he's looking at naughty websites that he shouldn't do. And it turned out that he's got this weird hyperfixation about goats. And he had been Googling the term brilliant goats again and again. And we asked him, well, why? He goes, well, I like goats. I just wanted to look up pictures of goats. He said, well, okay, but why brilliant goats? He goes, well, I only want to look at the good ones. Oh, okay, fair enough. Can't argue with that. It's 384 pages. Frankly, it could have been treble that. They provide so much material. I've not had to work too hard to because the children just provide the material. Sure. Quite. I guess that's having six children part of that. Yes. But they do provide an enormous amount of material, so it wasn't actually too hard to write.
No, that's good. Well, you know, it is. I think it's a nice, you know, it's a nice format. The A to Z, not necessarily all the right letters, but not necessarily in the right order, is fun, and also means that you can have a bit more of a narrative to it. So it sort of works better than a simple A to Z would be annoying because it wouldn't be the stories wouldn't come in the right order. So it's a clever little device. But yeah, it's as I say, I think anyone with zappers will find it. Very useful, and anyone with cold plays or a mixture
the people also have really enjoyed it. I know so far it's only been out a couple of months, but it's like teachers, people who are involved with carers, but also teachers, any professionals who are involved with children of different kinds of need. Not even just for parents. I hear a lot of teachers and other professionals I've really enjoyed it.
Well, you know, and it's a warning to anyone who doesn't have kids to never have kids, which is my advice anyway, because, you know, it's an absolute living nightmare.
Absolutely. I saw a review on Goodreads where somebody said, I love this book, gave it 5 stars, but said, I've now decided I'm never going to have children. Oh, no, what have I done? I don't know. I wasn't sure that was good or bad, but I genuinely saw that.
Well, it'd be a better world if everyone stops up. There are enough kids now, so let's all stop now. I've got mine, you've got yours, it's all fine. Is there anything, are you a big reader? Is there anything you're reading that is not by you that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
What am I? Well, at the moment I'm reading they don't need me to plug this because it's doing very well in all the jobs. You know about this, Catherine Rundle?
I do. Catherine's been a guest when she was talking about her John Donne book, which is amazing as well. But yes, she writes teenage fiction.
So this book, I mean, it says on the cover, you know, there was Tolkien, there was Pullman, and now there's this. I mean, and it is great. It's a really, really good book. So I'm enjoying that. I'm quite a big reader.
Yeah.
So, depending on what I'm doing, I will just go through phases where, like, I'll read 3 books in a week, and other times it'll take me like a month to get through something.
Well, that's still good. I'm only reading books because I now have to for this podcast, which is part of the reason I did it, because I like reading, but I find it very hard to find time to do it. Anyway, let's wrap it up there. Lovely to talk to you. Do buy the book, Normal Schmormal. We will be back next week with someone else. Thank you, of course, to Chris Evans, not that one, and Ben Evans, not that one. And we will see you next time with another very exciting book.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.